Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm lucky to be talking to James Wood. He is in an NPR studio in Boston. He is the author, most recently, of How Fiction Works, and I've been spending 2 weeks or so reading his other books as well, The Broken Estate, The Irresponsible Self, and his novel, The Book Against God. Having been the critic, the literary critic, the main literary critic for The New Republic, he's been writing for The New Yorker now. And it's easy to say that of the people who have a place in popular magazines, he is the best critic writing in years. In fact, his presence there is both a pleasure and a relief. And How Fiction Works seems a special kind of book. It's a primer of sorts. Who is it written for, James?
I think the easy answer is that it's written for the kind of person I was when I was about 20. It's exactly the kind of book when I was zealous with literary ambition, desperate to write my own fiction. That's another story. Full of plans and fantasies. It was the kind of criticism that I was after, academic enough, but also writerly enough to satisfy those kinds of yearnings.
So it's for would-be writers and readers?
I think so. The other part of the readership would be, I suppose, students of all ages. In the past few years, I've been teaching literature half-time at Harvard, so I have dealings with undergraduates. But in a way, more relevantly for this book, I've also done a couple of little master classes at Columbia with the MFA students who are studying studying fiction, want to write fiction, thinking hard about matters of technique, and are all ages. And in some ways, the book came out of those little master classes as much as anything else.
Now, I'm curious. I'm going to cite two incidents. Cocteau says about filmmaking that the only technique that counts is the technique you invent for yourself. And I think as well of a rather remarkable thing that the Georgia Review once published. It was Carolyn Gordon, her comments having read the manuscript of Flannery O'Connor's Wiseblood. And she's very carefully going page by page. It's a little bit of a chore to read because none of us have the original manuscript to compare to. But she's saying things that, once she says them, seem entirely commonsensical. Like Flannery, for something to exist on the page, you must appeal to the majority of the senses. That is at least 3 out of 5. Until you do, that object doesn't exist. It's very practical criticism and kind of devastatingly good, things you don't usually hear in writing classes. And when I gave it to young writers, by diligently following it, they managed to be diligent and nothing but diligent. So to what extent does talking about technique help a writer? Can it?
I don't know that it does. And in that respect, I wouldn't say that, that this book exists to be practically instructive in that way. What I want to do, in a sense, is submerge the reader in as many examples, in as many enactments of novelistic life as I can. That's why the book is so full of quotes. I mean, in a way, I've just sort of turned out my commonplace book, perhaps too overbearingly. But to immerse the reader in the business of fiction, and in a sense, rather than to instruct, to write a kind of essay around exactly what you're talking about, which is this central mystery. What is it that brings something to life on the page? It does seem that as soon as you start elaborating rules, you immediately kill it. On the other hand, it seems anti-intellectual to say that to assert that you can't try to talk about it. So, in the space between those two positions, I try to come back again and again to this question of what brings things to life on the page: detail, character, language, and so on.
Well, it's rather remarkable in that you do bring things to life in your criticism, and more than any critic I know writing now, describing the frustration, say, of Melville's disbelief, his need to create metaphor because his belief takes him into two worlds, or on the other hand, Virginia Woolf, when she's still a critic, being in a kind of lustful competition with the writers she's reviewing, needing to invent a literary language for criticism, but not yet quite her language for fiction. One senses in your reviews a level of passion and desperation, both, that seem very animate to me. To what extent, when you write, is that need to go beyond criticism into something passionate, more human, and really, in a way, to describe the intensity a true reading of a great book demands?
Well, I do think, and I've written about this perhaps too much, you know, the great joy of the literary critic, as you know, one distinct from the other critics, is that we use the medium that we're writing about. We don't have that necessary muffling that goes on if we were writing about art or writing about music. We're in the medium. So it seems to me there's a burden placed on the literary critic to ceaselessly enact a kind of a difficult parallelism. I think James talks about the critic as being heroically vicarious. Maybe on dull days it seems less than heroic, but but the vicariousness is always there, and it can be slightly absurd too on those dull days, slightly eunuch-like. On the good days, it seems like the proper competitiveness, that you're sidling up to the text in its own fluid, and not, of course, trying to outwrite it. That would be, I'm not so far into the Bloomian or Wildean world that I think of criticism as the primary activity, but that you are trying to do something with language that honors the language you're talking about and that has its own animate life.
Because for me, when I'm reading you at what I think is your best, there's that quality that Walter de la Mare had when he said that he hoped that in heaven he would meet Prince Hamlet. that is to say, someone to whom literature has meant something more than a profession, and someone whose brain has been perhaps beautifully addled by it.
Well, that's a very nice thing to say. Perhaps the more prosaic answer is that I always wanted to write fiction. First of all, I wanted to write poetry, perhaps like every decent novelist, and then realized I couldn't. Then started writing fiction, then realized I couldn't, more or less. And during my 20s, when I was establishing myself as a freelance critic in London, I was desperately aware of all my contemporaries, or some of my contemporaries, running away with the novel. They were writing their first books. For whatever reason, I couldn't do it. I was tearing up pages and not getting anywhere. So the blocked creative impulse is strong in me, and there's certainly a transference of sorts that I'm necessarily enthralled to when I write about fiction.
Now, in how fiction works, at least a good deal of the opening sections deal with something that a writer does. You call it the free and direct style, and it allows the writer to penetrate a character's consciousness. Its greatest practitioners, in a sense, when it comes to be a formal notion, include Flaubert and James. Mm. Flaubert especially, a writer who wants, he says, to retreat into invisibility. So later does James Joyce, up above, paring his fingernails. And it seems to me that what goes on, what these writers want, is the opposite of what you're doing in most of your criticism. that here we are meant to hear an impassioned voice. And that if that impassioned voice doesn't sound like a personal voice, what will it sound like? So it sounds as if the things that you're examining in the novel are almost the opposite of what gives character and voice to your fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. But I don't know about you. The critics I most enjoy, and Roland Barthes is a very good example, are contradictory critics. I go back to Barthes so much in the book because I think he was fundamentally right about realism, which he detested. And I think he went back to it again and again because he was paying a kind of negative tribute to it. He couldn't leave it alone. He had a sort of murderous hostility for it, which was inseparable from I think, his love for it or his awe of it. And I freely admit to contradictions myself. They were very obvious to me when I sat down and actually wrote a novel. Suddenly I found that the things I'd been writing about as a reviewer, you know, the writer holding back, honoring the character, not too much essayism or intellectual chit-chat, the finely implicit, the Chekhovian, all that stuff, I seemed to ignore it and produced a sort of talky novel, narrated, first-person, unreliable narrator, full of theological prosiness. These are humbling experiences. However, I would say about free and direct style that what I like is this combination of the invisible author and the author actually signing himself into the style at the same time.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with James Wood, author most recently of How Fiction Works, published by Farris, Rausch & Giroux. We'll continue after this short break. Thank you. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with James Wood about how fiction works. You talk in the first book, The Broken Estate, about Virginia Woolf's impatience. We can't be Edwardian anymore, she's saying. We can't write like Arnold Bennett. There is a new consciousness, and it's the writer's job to find and describe it. And her life, in a sense, is based upon making that attempt and often being rejected for it or severely criticized, or bringing herself to a level of sensibility and sensitivity where her own sanity is in question. And it's the invention of a new novel, as to some extent Flaubert's Bovary is an invention of a new novel. It seems to me, though, that in How Fiction Works, you argue not for the people who are attempting to bring the novel to a new frontier, but to a quieter kind of accomplishment. And yet, I know that the books you like in literary history are the books that break form or make new. So I'm wondering, is this a particularly bad time for a novelist, a young novelist, to work or attempt to find a new form? Let's take as a given that that form will be an adjunct or breakage of sorts of realism. I'm not questioning that, but does one praise the small but perfect emulation, or seek to champion the harpooner who's trying to pierce reality anew?
You get to the heart of an uncertainty in my criticism and perhaps in my sensibility. If you had to level a charge, one of many, I'm sure, against me, it would be that I am more alert to the breaking of old frontiers than to the, you know, the conquering of new ones in contemporary writing. It's not, of course, that there are contemporary writers I'm extremely interested in who I think are doing remarkable things. Norman Rush, for instance, I think is much neglected as an American novelist, but I think verbally he's really as interesting as the more vaunted, you know, David Foster Wallace. In other ways, he's a more conventional writer too. But I have to say to you that I'm not exactly sure. Perhaps this is the difference between the critic and the creative writer. I'm not exactly sure what new forms the novel can and must take. I mean, there are obviously new challenges, or challenges that are extensions, exaggerations of developments in the last 30 years. Things that have to do with, you know, the saturation of our consciousnesses by media languages, by various argos from, you know, text messaging, internet, and advertising, and so on. But you know, Beller was aware of those when he was writing Herzog. In some ways, things aren't hugely different. There are one obvious new dimension is the political situation we find ourselves in, and I think serious novelists are coming back again and again to the question of how to convincingly represent religious extremism, or not perhaps not even religious extremism, just the certainty of faith in a way that is not in a way that's convincing and not condescending. But even as I describe these particular challenges, they're tasks the novelist has to do. I'm not sure I'm very effectively describing how a new form is born. That's to say, I'm describing challenges of content.
Well, yes, but content leads to form. And I think, like all of us, we have moments where we feel that the future of the novel is not the rich and glorious thing that its past has offered us. Mm-hmm. But then I stop and think, you know, around the time when Ulysses was put at the top of the list of the top 100 novels, I was on the air with people from Ceylon and others as well, and the Ceylon lady said, I called everyone in the office and no one has read all of Ulysses. How could it be the top novel of the last 100 years, and why should we still read it? And it didn't take me long instinctively to answer, it did everything the novel knew how to do up to its point, and predicted everything the novel would find out how to do for the next 70 years.
Yeah.
So did Moby Dick.
Absolutely.
That's what we look to the novel for. We can't know what the novel will be, but we do know that nothing gets jettisoned.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that sense, I do think that we're still living... I mean, we are truly postmodern. We're still living in the aftermath of that extraordinary modernist explosion. I mean, Joyce essentially predicts everything, technically speaking, that will happen in Bellow's work, say in Herzog, which are softened modernist books, but they use the same sorts of techniques.
Well, he anticipates the Nouveau Roman.
Yeah,
you know, he does. And you know, and that's the thing. You know, we don't know who the next. You see, I think one of the things that's changed in these eras, the kind of genius that Melville was is not the kind of genius that Joyce was, and the genius who writes the novel that takes us on the next leap will not be the kind of genius either that Melville
Absolutely.
Or Joyce were.
Absolutely.
Times change the notion of genius. And we're
yes.
at a time where the notion of genius right now is so unfashionable that we know it's up for redefinition.
Well, absolutely. Now, I think you really put your finger on something that's important to me. It may be because at some level I have a fundamentally religious sensibility, but it seems to me that, you know, what isn't in short supply at the moment is talent or verbal ability. There are probably more. There may not be titanic figures around at the moment, but there are probably more really good novelists working in America than there were say 50 years ago. It may be that sheer competition, as in piano playing and wine making, just pushes up the general. Standard. I think you could almost say that. You could say that about the level of journalistic criticism being written in America at the moment in magazines and certainly in magazines and journals. But what seems to me, if not in short supply, then under threat is the thing you talk about when you talk about genius is seriousness. The creation of a grave sensibility, right? I mean, of a seriousness in which when someone sits down to write fiction, everything is at stake. I mean, humanly at stake, mm-hmm. metaphysically at stake.
I think that one of the things that how fiction works is sublime for is that it's almost an inventory of the things we once cherished both in life and in fiction, that now we face the obligation to find a new way to cherish, that that might be the job of the next great novelist.
Yeah.
How do we still love what we once loved, even in a new world?
Yes. I think that's absolutely right. And it's true that the danger of a book like How Fiction Works, which does deal with contemporary writing, but which perhaps has its face turned towards the past masters, is that there's a slight... Well, there's a danger, a slight flavor of the archaic, that, as you say, these are the things to be treasured and put between covers and remarked on. I hope that that thinking about them can lead serious writers forwards. I mean, you know, we were just talking a second ago about the metaphysically grave. One area where, you know, where inescapably we are going to be humbled as creatures is in this sense of the world quite literally slipping away from us environmentally. And I don't think it's any surprise that Cormac McCarthy's The Road was such a devastating book, but also such a popular one. It spoke to a new strain of apocalypticism, I think.
I've been talking with James Wood, author most recently of How Fiction Works, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you, James, for joining me.
Thank you.
You can read an excerpt from How Fiction Works at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it in your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Associate producer is Alan Howard. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Thanks to recording engineer Mike Toda, and special thanks to Glenn Alexander at radio station WBUR in Boston for his help in arranging this interview. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.